Well, the subtitle of this talk is How to Think About Empire, because I want to talk about perceptions and then how those perceptions are applied. So let's begin with some questions, okay? In this age of empire, how do we arrive at the truth? What is truth and objectivity? How do we achieve objectivity? I thought I'd start off with small questions and then build up. That's a joke. All right. The usual criticism made about objectivity is that it doesn't exist. We're not just passive receptors. You've heard that, haven't you? We don't just sponge up images and information. Perception involves a lot of selecting and omitting, organizing data into comprehensive forms. In a word, the act of perceiving is itself an act of editing, and therefore subjective. Like right now, you have literally countless numbers of stimuli that are coming at you visually, and you've edited most of them out, presumably focusing on the speaker and such, but you're not looking really at the texture of that plant over there or whatever. Almost 80 years ago, Walter Lippmann, he wrote a book called Public Opinion, and he said, we do not perceive things and then define it. We don't perceive reality and then define it. We first define it, and then we perceive it in accordance with our prefigured definitions. The problem, though, is the mental selectors we use to organize our perceptions are not mostly of our own creation. So this perception is not as subjective and as personal as we might think. Much of our personal perception is just not that personal. Rather, it's shaped by a variety of things outside of ourselves, such as the dominant ideology in the society, conventional social values, traditions, one's position in the social structure. You know, if you live on Wall Street, you have one perspective of reality. If you live under Wall Street, you have another. The available flow of information and disinformation, and the potential benefits and losses that are attached to the perception. If it's beneficial to you, you're more likely to perceive it. If it's something that might disadvantage or incur losses, you're more likely to refuse to perceive it. Almost 25 years ago, Alvin Gouldner, in his book called The Coming Crises in Western Sociology, he talked about the background assumptions. He said, we accept things because of the data and the information and the arguments that are presented usually. We accept things that are more readily congruent with our own background assumptions, what we think should be the case. And if these things don't fit that, then our tendency is to reject it. That has political significance, we will see. Today, an analogous concept to the background assumptions, or the climate of opinion was what Carl Becker called it. Today, the term might be the dominant paradigm, that what we face, at least a lot of dissidents, a lot of people who have a critical and progressive perspective, talk about confronting the dominant paradigm. Now, a paradigm is a philosophical or a theoretical framework within which empirical hypotheses are drawn and tested and scientific theory is developed. In common parlance, though, the dominant paradigm, in popular use, it really means the mainstream ideology. Maybe you've seen bumper stickers that says subvert the dominant paradigm. We've got them up in Berkeley, but we may not have them. dominant paradigm is based on a unanimity of basic assumptions. And that unanimity of basic background assumptions is what passes for objectivity in mainstream discourse. Well, if objectivity is really little more than a conformity of bias, then isn't one paradigm about as reliable or unreliable as another? And if that's so, then is all truth nothing more than just opinion and belief? And if not, what makes a dissident, heterodox, radical analysis better than a conventional, traditional, or orthodox analysis, one that comes from the dominant paradigm? Because I would argue that the radical perspectives are generally, not always, but generally better. And I'd argue it this way. First, the radical views that are outside the mainstream, generally, but not always, are more reliable than the dominant view because they're more regularly challenged and tested against evidence. They don't get a free float down the mainstream. They're not just accepted as the usual unexamined opinions that we hear again and again. The minute they come up is, where did you hear that? Why do you think that? What proof do you have of that? What's that? So that they're not supported by that unanimity of bias that passes for objectivity. They're not supported by the universe of discourse fabricated by the corporate media and by the dominant and credible and legitimate, or quote, policymakers in the White House and on down. Second, we can value an opinion by the functions it serves. The heterodox view has a special task. The heterodox, as opposed to the orthodox, contests the prevailing orthodoxy. It broadens the boundaries of debate. Its task is to wake people up, to unearth suppressed data, to get people to think critically about things that they've taken for granted or left unexamined. The functions of orthodox opinion is just the opposite: to keep the parameters of discourse as narrow as possible, to dismiss evidence that ill-fits the dominant paradigm, not to wake people up, but to keep them asleep, or to keep them in established knee-jerk responses. So all opinions are not of the same value. It depends on what they're being used for. In part, it depends on what they're being used for. It depends on what interests they serve. We've all observed that if something doesn't fit what people believe, then they marshal their reserve defenses. I mean, how many of you have experience where you talk to somebody and you give them some information that you see they're lacking, and they take this and they say, oh, I never knew this. Well, I've always believed the opposite, but now you're giving me this information, I will discard my beliefs and embrace yours. How many times has that happened? Right. People going, yeah, no, exactly. information becomes a very thin and frail weapon. We've all observed that if something doesn't fit what people believe, they summons up these reserve defenses. I just said that, right? No, maybe not. Okay, but there are these reserve fallback positions, I call them. And so when, rather than getting agreement, you'll get an argument that's attenuated further back. It's sometimes called visiting relatives. No, that's the kind of I remember I taught at Cornell years ago, and I was teaching a course on the media. It was for seniors and juniors. And about halfway through the semester, or a third through the semester or so, a couple of students said, in the class, they said, we're getting only one perspective in this class. We're getting only one viewpoint. And And I said, well, no, we've got this reading and that reading, and I don't agree with these readings and that reading. And we discuss other different opinions in the class. And then I said, but you know, you're right. You're absolutely right. That for the most part, you're getting a perspective that's very critical of the mainstream media from a progressive perspective. That's true. And then I said, how many of you have had social science courses before? That's sociology, political science, economics, history, communications, media, that stuff, psychology, social psychology. And everybody's hands went up. Everybody had at least 4, 5, 6 courses more. I said, and in all those other courses you had, how many of you ever got this perspective? And no hands went up. I mean, it really actually surprised me. This is a measure of the ideological freedom and diversity of Cornell University. No hands went up. And then I said, and how many of you in those other courses complained about getting only one perspective and not getting this critical perspective? And again, no hands went up. So I said, so your complaint now is not that you're getting only one perspective, but that for the first time you're getting a different perspective and you don't like it and you find it intolerable and you don't, and you're complaining. You want to get back to the old ideological cocoon that Cornell has so successfully and inadvertently put you in. Maybe not so inadvertently. Well, when the orthodox view becomes so entrenched, then evidence becomes irrelevant. I give an example. Here's a real hard case, because it involved even a lot of progressive people got roped in on this one. And that is the demonization of the Serbian people and their democratically elected president, Slobodan Milosevic, who was demonized back in, when was it, 1999 or so, late 90s. That was one of the great propaganda achievements. It took in many liberals and progressives who stood shoulder to shoulder, supporting Bill Clinton's war, 78 days and nights of bombing Yugoslavia, stood shoulder to shoulder with Clinton and the White House and the CIA and NATO and those fellas. After the war, you know, even Carla Del Ponte, who was the hanging judge in this kangaroo court that was set up by the Americans and the British, at which Milosevic was tried, and he was never able to launch his defense because he died suddenly in jail. even Carla Del Ponte said, she said that we don't have enough prosecutorial evidence to really bring a case against the Serbians for war crimes or against Milosevic for war crimes. Serbia, I would point out, I was there in 99, just a few weeks after all the bombing. Serbia was the only republic that actually was multi-ethnic and wasn't cleansing, unlike Croatia and Bosnia and Kosovo. Carla Del Ponte just wrote her memoirs in which she mentioned only two-line thing buried deep in her memoirs, that the Albanian KLA were going out and kidnapping Serbian youth and harvesting their organs for the market. Just right there, Carla Del Ponte, right in there. Now, I wrote a book called To Kill a Nation, and I was sort of treated like I had committed a criminal act. I relied on evidence drawn almost overwhelmingly from the United Nations and NATO sources and the mainstream media and to show that this whole war was based on lies and misrepresentations. But what I really found was that such evidence as I marshaled was irrelevant. People had made up their minds through the process of repetition, hitting home again and again and again and again and again. You come along with a mere thing like the truth, what has that got to do with anything? I have an article, if you go to my website, article I wrote some years ago. This is another example. I must almost like a happy puppy press my nose against the buzz saw. I take on these issues that then I get whacked pretty hard for. On this one, I took on the myth of Shangri-La and old Tibet. I've been reading about Tibet, and what we know is that the Dalai Lama had this wonderful, beautiful, loving, religious culture, country, and the Chinese came in and took it over and drove them out, and it's been misery and oppression ever since. I looked at old Tibet before the Chinese takeover, carefully saying again and again, I am not supporting the Chinese government. There's much that they do that I criticize. I even put some stuff at the end of the article about it. But I want to tell you that old Tibet was no Shangri-La. It was a serfdom country. The people, all right, as late as 1959, worked as serfs. They worked from dawn to dusk. Many of them indebted. The monasteries, the rich lamas, the rich landlords owned all the land. People were mutilated for theft or for running away if they were serfs. All sorts of stuff I was putting, and I was just citing these different things. Wow, what I got back. I mean, you must not deprive people of their illusions or their dreams. Oddly enough, the article now is exploding all over the internet. The Chinese have got a crap over it. Or these Chinese in America, I still get the hate mail, some of them rather vicious, from people who are loving, transcendent, beautiful Buddhists. It would be surprising they have Buddhists. Die and your guts go this and that. Beautiful, all beautiful. The Dhamma body of Buddha himself right there, I can see. So that's where it's really hard to argue these hard cases. And what you hope for is not necessarily that someone embraces your opinion, but that someone thinks about their own a little more. And has that less of that knee-jerk parrot syndrome. In fact, that's what I said. That's what I said in Contrary Notions. That it's not that I want to get you to embrace my opinions, but examine your own. As to what is truth, this elusive thing called the truth. What is it? What's really the truth? We can kind of back into that question by saying that we know truth exists because we know liars exist. We may not always know when our rulers are lying to us, but after a while, we begin to catch on. You know the saying that you can't fool all the people all the time, but if you do it once, it's good for 4 years. Or eight, right? No, they got to steal the election the second time. One way of maintaining the dominant paradigm is by the slighting of content, is what I call it. That is, you decontextualize the issue. Never go too far into social reality. Never link immediate events, mishaps, conflicts, and outrages to larger sets of social relations, which is what we radicals do. We link these things to larger sets of social relations. Rather than looking at poverty and saying the poor are the authors of their own poverty, we say, where does poverty come from? There's a whole system here. Why is it that most of the people who are poor also work, and they work very hard, and they work long hours? Some of them even work two jobs. Why then are they poor? Are they poor because the poor shall always be with ye? Or are they poor because there's a set of social relations and interests and forces that are operative here, having to do with high rents, low wages, high taxes, high prices, and profiteering, and whatever else? That's an off-the-cuff example. And what I just did was to pose a systemic analysis. For instance, instead of bemoaning the juxtaposition of great wealth with great poverty and saying, isn't this a shame, all this wealth and all this poverty? Oh, if only we can make a more equitable distribution of it instead of just bemoaning it and deploring it. And we get so busy denouncing some of these things, let's also try to understand why. Why do they exist? Let's contextualize that phenomenon. And what we would find is that this wealth and this poverty are not just in juxtaposition, or they are in juxtaposition only because there's a causality between them. That the accumulation of wealth is what creates poverty. That you can have rich landlords only if you have poor slaves and serfs. That you can have rich plutocrats only if you have people who are working harder and harder and harder. Today, this past year, 4 American workers produced all year what last year 5 used to produce. So there's been an increase in productivity. There's been a speed up. Did those 4 workers get a 20% increase? No, they didn't. Wages, in fact, were flat and have even in real buying power have declined. So something's happening. Surplus value is being created. People are working even harder. Fewer workers are turning out even more. And yet they're not getting much back. So there's the connection between wealth and poverty. Now, in the face of the kind of informational vapidity, informational emptiness, not informational scarcity. There's plenty. There's tons of information out there. There's more than you can even handle or absorb in news, in talk shows, radio news slots. I mean, 24 hours a day you can get news coming in, not to mention the internet, where everybody's become a self-created, syndicated columnist and sends you their columns and writes all those things and all that. But most of the mainstream media is vapid disinformation or non-information, if you will, superficial information. And I call it so many empty calories, so lacking in nutrients. It's sort of like when you eat a big meal of all these calories and you come away and you sort of want to eat more because you really didn't get that surge of nutrients, and it gets harder and harder at times to do that. In the face of that kind of stuff, the dissemination of simple facts can be a radical act. Quoting Carlo Del Ponte, for instance, about not having any sufficient evidence of a genocide, it becomes a radical thing to be embraced by very few. Having said all this, we shouldn't conclude that people are always unreceptive and recalcitrant as communicatees. I think I've already made that clear. When communications fit into their presumed field of assumptions, they swallow the message without chewing it over. People will hear an opinion on the air, and it's amazing how often that happens. People will just hear something on the air, and they'll repeat it. Unedited, unexamined, they'll just suddenly incorporate it as their own opinion. And uninformed, prepackaged. This is what I call this the parrot syndrome. I'll give you examples of what our people do. By our people, I mean progressive people who are concerned about the state of the world and oppose elite privileges and the like. By the way, people standing in the back, there are some seats up here, prime premier seats, high price seats right up here in the front row over there if you want to. Amen. The national debt, again and again, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, the national debt is terrible. The national debt, and it is terrible. The national debt is something that's created by right-wing reactionary Republicans. When Ronald Reagan came into office, in 1980, the national debt was $800 billion. When he left office 8 years later, the national debt was $2.5 trillion. When George Bush Sr. came into office at that point, in 4 years, the national debt grew to $4.5 trillion. Now, Clinton, in his 8 years, I'll give him credit for that, he did produce some surpluses and actually kept the debt level. The national debt is the annual budgetary deficit. Every year, the government spends billions of more dollars than it takes in. How can the government do that? It does it by borrowing money. Who does it borrow from? It borrows money from the people who have money, from rich creditors in America who like to buy up treasury bonds and know that these bonds are safe and will be realized later on. And not all Americans, some of them are foreigners too. That accumulation of yearly deficits is what's called the national debt. Okay, after Clinton left office and Bush Jr. came into office, the national debt, as I said, was $4.5 trillion. In 8 years, Bush has more than doubled the national debt. It will be, by the time he leaves, very close to $10 trillion in debt. These guys always talk about the Democrats being big spenders and wild spenders. They are the biggest deficit spenders there are. They like a huge deficit. The huge deficit paralyzes domestic spending. A huge deficit means that an upward redistribution of income. That is, you take tax dollars from the taxpayers and you give it to the rich creditors who own the national debt. So it's a way of privatizing the federal budget. It means a larger and larger portion of each dollar that you pay in taxes doesn't go for services that you may need. It goes into the pockets of rich creditors. We are borrowing money from the people we should be taxing. And meanwhile, that George Bush, at the same time, he cut all these huge taxes. He gave huge tax cuts to the corporations, to the very super rich, that quarter of 1%, not the top 20%, no, that really quarter of 1% that really owns most of the wealth and income in this country and in much of the world. So, how did I get onto that? It was about when people would get up and say, and this national debt is a burden that we are giving to our children and grandchildren. And sometimes with a little sob in the voice too, you know, this was like, just give us a tug and our guts and say, oh, our children, our grandchildren. And I always have to get up and say, you talk to some 20-year-old about their grandchildren. I mean, they're worrying about getting a job tomorrow, and you're talking about their imaginary grandchildren who won't be coming around the bend for another 40, 50 years, maybe. Why don't you say the national debt is killing us right now? It's destroying it. Hospitals are closing. All these kinds of terrible things are happening to our own country, the quality of life, and the national debt is one of the things that's doing that to us. Another example is the environment. They do the same thing. You know why they do that? Because that's what they heard other people do. They heard other people say, our children and our grandchildren. And you hear about the environment. We've got to do something about the environment. Otherwise, our children and our grandchildren. What are you talking about? It's happening right now. We're in a crisis. We've got Antarctica dropping off a chunk of ice the size of New York State or something every week or so. We've got incredible ecological aberrations going on. By the end of this century, why, who knows, who the hell's going to be alive by the end of this century? This is only 08, you know. That's another 92 years. Some of you will be alive. but I don't think you'll care one way or the other by then. you'll be about 115, 120, But again, what you always hear is our children and our grandchildren, which they give away the polemical point. And they say it, why do they say it? Our grandchildren, I heard this just recently at a conference, a guy got up and said, we've got to talk about this because this will affect our grandchildren. Nobody in that room had grandchildren. But you say that because you heard others say it, and so like a little parrot, you just repeat it and do it. So let's think a little more critically and ruthlessly and relentlessly, and not just incorporate these little capsules of opinion like little tapes and take them out and plug them into your head and play it. That's not being a free person. Now, in the U.S., people do distrust politicians. We often hear politicians are manipulators, they can't be trusted, they say one thing and do another, and I think that's quite true. The very word politician has a pejorative ring. But when these same politicians involve our nation in foreign conflict and wars of aggression, then millions of people fall into line. They rally around the flag, and the flag is wrapped around the president, and they suddenly, like with all the innocence of our children and grandchildren, they listen and believe whatever the president says. And they, not only that, but they take any critical resistance to what the president is doing as a lack of patriotism, as a betrayal of the nation. There are two major propaganda themes, if we're looking at perception and deception. The two major themes by which political leaders rally popular support for wars and global interventions and a whole global empire as we have today are, one, the messianic nation theme, that America is a messianic nation. God's gift to humanity. We are the purveyors of all that's good in the world. We are the purveyors of democracy and the like, and we're the best. The other and even more effective theme that is played again and again is not pride, not national pride, not messianic pride, but fear. The play on fear, that it's a world of enemies, maniacally, mentally imbalanced, demonized leaders in every country where the leader has pursued a self-developing or self-defining course, in every country where that's happened, that leader has been pilloried as a mentally crazy or unstable or demonized in some way. Milosevic was an example. Gaddafi in Libya, Noriega in Panama, Allende in Chile, and any leader who's targeted and then killed and kicked away, Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein was a terrible leader. But Saddam Hussein is a very good case of decontextualizing the reality. Because for 5 years, we have heard about how bad Saddam Hussein is, and that's true. What the media never mentioned, and it's cut off, it's decontextualized, what all the finality of any state censor would do, you cut off any mention of the fact that Saddam Hussein was created by the U.S. He was a CIA protege. His first gig was to assassinate the democratically elected prime minister. Which he muffed, he just wounded him, and then he was taken out. And that was given to him by the CIA. Saddam Hussein, when he was murdering and torturing every Democrat, every progressive, Iraqi, every constitutionalist, every communist, every one of them, when he was, and including liquidating and killing the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist party, when he was doing that, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They couldn't give him enough weapons, and they couldn't give him enough aid and all that. It's only when he started being self-defining and he kept the economy publicly owned and he wanted a bigger chunk of the oil market quotas to be able to sell Iraqi oil, which might have threatened oil prices. George Bush Sr. was openly afraid of that. You could read articles right there on the business page of the New York Times. Cartels worried about oil prices going low. That's when Saddam Hussein suddenly became this wicked enemy that we had to do something about. So what you do is you demonize the leaders, and in that way you can you can destroy and bomb their people and wipe out their infrastructure and the like. Now those two themes, I listened, very interesting, I thought it was George W. Bush's 2007, maybe it was 2006, State of the Union message, and in which he wove both those themes. You have to use both those themes. You have to say, we're the messianic nation. You don't say messianic. You say, we are the superpower in the world. We are keeping a strong America. We're a world leader. We need a strong military to keep us safe and save the world. So there's a self-congratulatory global triumphalism. But at the same time, while you're saying what a great job we're doing, because I'm the president of the State of the Union, you also got to say how terrible it is. It's kind of an odd thing. It's really, things are really wonderful because of my leadership. Things are really terrible, so you better come in line and let me do what I want to you. At the same time, they have to talk about U.S. vulnerability, and which George Bush did, 9-11, talk about a parrot. 9-11. In 2004, almost all his campaign speeches, he would mention 9-11 about 3, 4, 5 times per speech about how we've been attacked by this terror. There's a terror out there. Our enemies are relentless. Our enemies never rest. They never sleep. We are not safe. We must act against them, etc. So you got those two things. Now this brings us to the subject of empire. Because there, the absence of content and context and political economic reality is really evident in empire. When I was writing my book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, I discovered that much of the historic literature on empire is rather favorable. That there are an awful lot of historians who kind of look favorably upon empires. Empires are seen as grand accomplishments. They bring stability, they bring peace and dominion, where before there was nothing but a bunch of squabbling tribes that were always at war with each other. We even give empires peace names. We talk about the imperialists do it themselves, the empire builders. We talk about Pax Americana, Pax Romana. The Romans did, Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Rome would so conquer the world and bring peace. Nobody could fight with anybody else anymore. They were all in chains now, working for Rome. There was Pax Britannica, and there's even Pax Americana. There is, Ronald Steele wrote a book called Pax Americana. He was critical of it. Empires are often seen as innocent, unintentional accretions, growths, that is. They arise stochastically. Stochasticism is the theory that things occur by chance, randomly. Stuff just happens. In my younger days, I used to hear that the British Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. That phrase has also been used. Cyril Robinson used it for the Roman Empire. He said, very much like the British Empire, the Roman Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. More recently, 2003, after the U.S. invaded Iraq, in The Economist, a conservative British publication, very prestigious one, by the way, it wrote as follows. In response to the U.S. being in Iraq, empires are born in funny ways, and sometimes via the law of unintended consequences by accident. So they're still pushing this line. I mean, it's hard to believe. They're still telling us that empires, and you hear it in different ways from American policymakers too. They'll talk about how the U.S. just found itself after World War II as the world leader. We were just pushed onto the stage, into a role that that wasn't of our own bidding. And who did the pushing? They don't say. But there we were. Well, I'm sorry, empires are not innocent, absent-minded, accidental, unintentional, stochastic accretions. They are given force by purpose-driven rulers who consciously mobilize vast amounts of men and materials who consciously conquer and plunder far-off places. The British didn't just happen to find themselves in India. You know, they went there. They went with gunboats, and they went with armies, and they recruited even some native legions and such to subdue the country, to take its markets, to destroy its production, to reap its natural resources. Empires kill people and impoverish people. That's a fact that's almost never noticed. One of the things about an empire, what's an empire? It kills people and it impoverishes them, while it also enriches other people. I wrote in my book Against Empire in 1995 that, I wrote this book called Against Empire, and I applied it to America. I was applying the word empire to America. And now, 1995, people said to me, aren't you going over the top here? I mean, we have a foreign policy law, but the United States is not an empire. You're being polemical, blah, 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 and all that. The United States does not pursue empire. It propagates democracy. In fact, when I was a kid, I remember the teacher saying, but the United States does not have any colonies. We have only territories. Well, by the year 2000, everybody was writing books. Everybody was writing books about empire, and everybody was talking about the United States. You had books called Sorrows of Empire, Follies of Empire, Twilight of Empire, Empire at the Crossroads, Empire Going to Get Your Mama. I made up that last one. Even conservatives started using the word empire. They say, we're an empire, and we've got to act like an empire. We're a superpower, and we've got to do it. And we're the strongest nation in the world, and we have every right to act as such. And we shouldn't be sitting back and being wimpy, yeah, like we're being wimpy, bombing two countries right now, waging two wars in two different countries, and with bases in about 70 other places. The largest military budget, spending more on the military than all the other countries in the world put together. And they're calling that wimpy. We're not acting strong enough. So how is it, I ask myself, that so many people now, not all of them with my politics either, some of them conventional, some of them even right-wingers, feel free to talk about empire, and they mean the U.S. empire. And had they all read my book? No, of course not. And I realized that the word, they could use the word empire because it was divested of its full meaning. Empire, the way they used it, seems to simply mean dominion and power. Its scope, control. What's missing from the public discourse is the process of empire. How do they get this control and such? And the political economic content. What does this empire do besides just say, hello, we're an empire? And here we are. What the problem is, I began noticing in all these books, is we hear a lot about empire, but we don't hear a word about that other word, imperialism. Now that's strange, because imperialism is the process of empire. That's what empires do. Empires do imperialism. It's not only the process, it's the political, economic content. An empire is not power just for power's sake. An empire is there to pursue real material interests. Plunder, tribute, control of natural resources, control of markets, expropriating the land, the crops, the cheap labor, or in the case of Rome, slave labor. Empires are enormously profitable, mostly for the ruling and owning class of the imperial nation. And empires are enormously costly for the common people, both in the victims of empire and the common people of the United States itself. And in the United States, last 20 years, growth of this global empire, has it really led to a rise in the standard of living in America? Quite the opposite. The empire feeds off the republic's resources. The people pay the taxes and do without essentials so that the patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. And when I mean their plunder, I mean their plunder. When they go after the oil, they don't go after it in some country that says, we're not going to sell any oil to you Americans. We're going to let you freeze to death in the winter and not have any oil for your cars. Nyah, 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 nyah. There's no oil-producing country in the world that isn't ready to sell oil to the U.S. and wants some of the oil quota. The fight with Saddam Hussein wasn't that he was going to keep the oil from us, but that he wanted a bigger chunk of the market, and that was jeopardizing prices. So we could get the oil by buying it like other people do, but then the oil cartels would only have that markup of the crude to getting the gasoline. They want to have the whole thing. They want to have the whole profit. Why buy the oil, Exxon says, when we could own the oil that's in, that our oil that just happens to be in your grounds there that you've got to hand over to us. So the patricians pursue their far-off plunder. The center of the empire is bled while the perimeter, so that the perimeter can keep expanding and expanding. And what comes with it? Here's our part of the empire. This is our part. Aside from the flag waving, that they wave in your face all the time, and the saluting, and the proud to serve and die and get my legs blown off. And aside from that part, there's this part. There's a runaway defense budget. It's now up to $650 billion. He almost doubled that defense budget, and he was able to do that, that military budget, he was able to do that by perpetrating these wars. Another $2 trillion have been spent in 4 years to destroy Iraq and Afghanistan. The estimates are $2 trillion, some go even to $3 trillion more. It depends on what you define as cost of war. You should really include the veterans' costs and benefits and medical costs of many who come back, the interest that you have to pay on this ballooning national debt, you know, that growing interest from the war and all that spending. That all has to be a cost. And here at home, you have public hospitals closing, libraries are cutting their hours, federal programs for disabled children are being opposed by the White House. Just 2 months ago, your president cut that out, right? Didn't he cut that out? Disabled children, conservation programs being cut, Medicare is under siege, as is Medi-Cal also. Education funding is cut, the states go begging, and what do? They keep raising tuitions on public education, which is a way of privatizing public education. Every time they keep raising your tuition, you have less of a public education, and more it's your private effort having to buy and pay each of those credits. So all these writers talk, many of them talk about empire without ever mentioning imperialism. And why do they do that? Because they either want to consciously or they just unconsciously want to stay within the dominant paradigm. They prefer to make a liberal complaint about how bad and stupid the policy is rather than a radical analysis about how successful and ruthless and advantageous the policy is for certain interests. They assume a community of interest between the plutocratic investors and the working people of the recipient nations when there is no community of interest. They assume a community of interest between us and George Bush when there is no community of interest. In other words, they don't have any kind of analysis of class interest or class power. I'm not one of those who believe that U.S. leaders are bumpkins and they're stupid. I mean, they do make mistakes. They do miscalculate. They expected the Iraq war to be a quick, clean thing. But they had a keen, and they have a keen and persistent sense of what their interests are. The war in Iraq, they give reasons. Justify the war, weapons of mass destruction, Al-Qaeda links. These have all been proven false. I'm not going to revisit that. But that doesn't mean the policy is stupid. That doesn't mean the policy is confused. It just means they were lying to you. When someone tells you something is incorrect, it could be that they're ill-informed, or they're just incorrect or confused. It could also mean that they're lying. Duh, remember lying? Politicians, lies? Okay. Because our rulers try to mislead and confuse us doesn't necessarily mean that they themselves are confused and misled. The war in Iraq is not a stupid blunder, nor is it a well-intentioned humanitarian undertaking that went awry. The Iraq war has been very good for a number of interests. I've already mentioned some of them. It served notice to the Middle East and the world that countries which chart an independent, self-defining, self-developing course risk being destroyed. The war has helped making the world safe for the free market global empire, that only certain free market multinational investors shall decide how you develop or what and such. 100 companies have made billions and billions of dollars in government contracts. 113 billion barrels of quality crude, some of the best in the world, at today's prices must be what? $35 trillion. The biggest resource grab in the history of the world is being taken over. Oil concessions that Saddam Hussein had made with Russia, France, Malaysia, Italy, Brazil, China, all canceled. Now it's the Americans and the Brits who will get direct ownership of that oil in trustee and stewardship. They will get it for what I think is something like 50 years or so. Iraqi oil is kept off the market, and the record high oil prices now, over $100 a barrel. The Iraq war has allowed Bush to increase the defense budget, almost doubling it. Iraq has had switched from dollars to euros under Saddam Hussein as its reserve currency, which was a threat to dollar investors. Not anymore, it's back on the dollar. Iraq supported the Palestinian liberation. Not anymore, all that has been stopped. Iraq had an entirely state-owned economy. Not anymore. Everything has been privatized or smashed by the war. Iraq was prosperous and of some influence in the Middle East. No more, no more. It's the world's worst basket case now. This is not U.S. ignorance or confusion at work. It's not good intentions gone awry. It is deliberate, conscious reactionism and imperialism at work. Bush and Cheney knew what they wanted to do, and they did it. This brings us to another question about perception and deception, and I'll wind it down. I've only got a couple more points. Do those who put forth the lies of empire believe what they tell us? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. That an opinion, see, the fact that an opinion serves someone's self-interest doesn't mean the opinion is hypocritically embraced, or they just take that opinion because they really want to advance their interest. The more it serves their interest, the more sincerely they believe in it. Of course, they think, oh yes, this is right. Oh yes, America should do this, oh yes. It becomes very persuasive by the very fact that it's so serviceable. So they do believe in the dominant paradigm. It defines their world for them. It assures them of their self-worth, that they have rightful access and possession of all their wrongfully acquired privileges and wealth. They believe in this the social structure as it is. They said about George Bush, he was born on third base and grew up believing he had hit a triple. They believe very sincerely, along with their progenitors, Alexander Hamilton, that the country should be run by the rich and the well-born. They completely believe they're deserving of their station in life. They believe that America should lead the world and that they should lead America. And they believe the poor are the authors of their own poverty and the working class are a troublesome lot who need to be reined in, along with the middle class, both of whom have to ratchet down their standard of living a lot more and learn to work harder for less. It was Paul Volcker when he was head of the Federal Reserve, who said, Americans are going to have to get along on less. You're going to have to do with less. They have to do that. Work harder for less so that those at the top can still get richer and richer. Get America back to what it was before we began to make some egalitarian gains and close some of that enormous gap. Do they believe the propaganda they put out in support of specific policies? Well, sometimes we know they deliberately lie and fabricate. You know that when you catch them in inconsistencies, when on day one they say one thing, and on day two they say another. I just saw a clip last night in Comedy Central. When you sit in a hotel, you watch TV, why not? And it was a Dick Cheney talking in 92. He said, we shouldn't go into Iraq, it's a quagmire, and you know, and it's not, there was no interest at that point to have to go into Iraq. Later on, suddenly the same Dick Cheney saying, the world depended, America's security and safety depended on us going into Iraq. You know something's funny here. Okay. The thing is, truth isn't a consideration. When you say, do they believe in the truth of what they say? That's not a consideration. It's more like the advertising world. The prime consideration in selling a product is not, is it true, but will it sell? Will this message sell? If this message sells, then it works. If it works, then it's, quote, true. If it doesn't work, then it's discarded. The approach to the truth is purely instrumental and manipulative. Okay. Well, you know, there are some of us who do believe there still is room for hope, however. There are sometimes limits to how well officialdom and the corporate press can finesse reality. Sometimes the reality principle applies. For instance, when they're telling you we're winning the war, I heard this for 10 years with Vietnam, we're winning the war, and everybody kept saying, we're not winning, it's horrible war. But you notice how even in that debate, how the dominant paradigm holds the discourse to very narrow parameters. Those of us who weren't against the war because it couldn't be won, we're against it whether you win it or lose it, we're against the war because it didn't support the interests of the American people or the Vietnamese people or in this case the Iraqi people. Those people don't really get on the mainstream media that often. We said it doesn't matter what the results are. The intervention was an imperialist crime against humanity, and it destroyed and killed people at great cost to our republic, a terrible, horrible cost to them. The question of empire was never addressed in regard to Vietnam, nor even with Iraq. But keep in mind that the indoctrination, this dominant paradigm, does not operate with perfect effect. It doesn't have totalistic control. If it did, I would not be able to give this talk. You would not be able to understand what I'm saying. In the face of all monopolistic ideological manipulation, some people still develop a skepticism toward the official ideology. Reality is a problem for the ruling class, not for us. It has to be constantly finessed and misrepresented, because reality is radical. And there's a limit to how many lies people will swallow about the radical reality they are experiencing. So when I say that the number of people living in poverty is growing at a faster rate than the world's population, that's not my ideology, that's not my radical ideology speaking, that's the radical reality of conditions. I didn't make that up. That's true. When we say that 61% of corporations have paid no taxes of any kind, that you have paid more taxes than Exxon or some other big corporation, that's not my ideology. That's pointing to the radical condition of reality. So the things that we want to expose, the things they've got to hide, that's called reality. And they're the ones who have to finesse that. They're the ones who, and they do a very good job. They constantly create narratives and scenarios and tell you that, government is the problem, they want to spend, we don't want to spend. And they continually lie and lie That's why much of the struggle has to be waging a counter viewpoint, a counter narrative, a counter paradigm, so that people can begin to see these things in a context that gives them meaning. And there's evidence of that happening. You mustn't get disheartened. There are people today who are demonstrating against the war. There's the Winter Soldier groups. There's the Iraqi Veterans Against the War, who are giving testimonies that would have been called treasonous some time ago. Talk about the hateful role, about the shame they feel, the pride they felt about being serving in the U.S. military, and then the horrible crimes and the nightmares they've had about these things and the like. There are millions who are no longer signing up to go serve in the military. There are people who are questioning it. Along with the ruling class coercion, we have mass resistance and skepticism. Along with institutional stability, we have popular ferment and popular innovation. And we really have to, maybe just the point that we have to do more direct actions of various kinds. All social institutions of capitalist society have a tension in them. They must sustain the interests of the few while appearing to serve the many. Don't think our rulers are not interested in what you think. That's a central focus. Every day, it's a major concern. Every day they send out press releases, messages, and such. It's a major concern to let you know that everything's okay, and you just, all you have to do is pay your taxes and believe what they say and do what they say. They lie and they conjure up false issues to distract, to flatter, or frighten people, or in some other way to win over and immobilize the public. Or sometimes, when the ferment is so persistent and all, they have to make real concessions to democratic demands. And that's our opening, and that's our hope. Years ago, there was an American philosopher named William James, and he observed how custom and culture can operate as a sedative, as the dominant paradigm, the parrot syndrome, all the things we're talking about, while novelty and dissidence are rejected as an irritant, as I told you how those Cornell University students react. Yet I would argue that after a while, sedatives can become suffocating and irritants can enliven. People sometimes hunger for the discomforting perspective that gives them a more meaningful explanation. By becoming aware of this, we have a better chance of moving against the tide instead of floating down the garbage of the mainstream. A better chance of resisting the deadening hand of fundamentalist free market plutocracy and exposing the dominant paradigm for the suffocating, dirty little box that it is. Thank you for your kind attention.